This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Wild fans, I need your help tonight. This team needs our help tonight. Let's tie this up. All right? So sing it with me. I want them to hear this all the way in Winnipeg. You hear me? Let's go.
18 seconds to the middle of the ice, broken up. Wheeler sends this ahead. At the empty net is Mark Scheifele. Scheifele scores! Mark Scheifele into the empty net with 10.7 seconds left to go. And the Winnipeg Jets will take a 3-1 series lead.
Well, the anthem singer's request didn't quite work last night. Pretty sure that guy's never going to sing the anthem again in St. Paul, Minnesota. Again, my theory on anthem singers. Sing the song, do a good job, maybe wave, and then get off the ice. Don't start being the rooting party. You know, follow Stacey's lead here in the peg. Sing the song, do a great job, give a thumbs up, be gone. The St. Paul, the Wild anthem singer, learned a lesson last night. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we welcome you to NHL This Week with Illegal Curve. Drew Mindell, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio for the next couple of hours. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is illegalcurve.com. Gentlemen, it was quite the game last night in St. Paul, Minnesota. We just heard Dennis Bayak's call of the Mark Scheifele empty net goal. That made it 2-0. That was what sealed the deal for the Winnipeg Jets. They take a commanding 3-1 series lead with a tremendous effort, bouncing back from the Game 3 disappointment and really taking a stranglehold on this series as we enter Game 5 on Friday night back here in Winnipeg with the Jets looking to clinch on home ice.
Yeah, Drew, I think the Jets were hoping to come back from St. Paul with a couple of victories, but it obviously didn't go how they scripted it on Sunday night. They end up losing 6-2. And, you know, going into this Game 4, I was really curious to see how Connor Hellebuyck was going to respond. And, guys, we know that Hellebuyck has been really good after allowing 4 or more goals in a game, and he was fantastic. He didn't need to make 40 saves, but he made a couple of really big saves early. He makes a really big save on Eric Staal in the first period, and then early in the second period on a 3-on-1, he makes a huge save on Matt Dumba. You know, Hellebuyck did what he has been doing the entire year, and that's be the Jets' best player. I mean, guys, that was probably as good of a defensive game you're going to see from a playoff team. And I thought the Jets played really well and did a much better job at controlling the neutral zone. The Jets were just giving the Wild too much in Game 3 on Sunday night, and really that was the difference for me. Yes, Hellebuyck played very well, made some big saves in key moments, Sean, but for me that was the difference in the game. The Jets really just didn't give the Wild a lot of time and space out there.
Yeah, the one thing that really stood out to me was the Jets regained not only their speed, but their tenacity and their hunger for the puck when they didn't have it, when they weren't controlling the play. We saw them kind of get away from something we've been used to seeing throughout the year where they're just tenacious and hard and they don't let the puck carrier go without a little bit of, you know, pesterizing or, you know.
Pesterizing.
That's
not a word, but I like it. I mean, I know what you're saying.
Pesterization?
Well, it's a word now, Drew.
you're digging your hole a little bit deeper there, but I like it. I know what you're saying by pesterizing. I like it.
I'm butcherizing.
Drew, Sean's going to pesterize you off the show in a second.
He might.
But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
That tenacity for the puck and to get it back, and we saw that yesterday. And like as he was talking about, the Jets really controlled the neutral zone, not so much through traffic, but they kept the Wild to the outside. A lot of the shots, especially in the third period, mm-hmm. came from the outside, and they did a much better job in Game 4 of boxing out in front of Connor Hellebuyck, which is, I think, possibly what kind of led to that Staal cross-check, because Morrissey is probably making a conscious effort to protect the house. You know, put the stick up, don't let guys go near Hellebuyck. He's looking for a rebound game, and, you know, emotion takes over, and Staal's a big boy leaning in, Morrissey not as big, and we all saw the video and whatever, but I thought the Jets did a much better job of keeping the Wild to the outside and protecting the house.
Well, let's talk about the cross-check. wasn't intentional. I think they're, I don't think anybody's really disputing that. Maybe Wild fans are disputing whether or not it was intentional. And nobody's disputing that it was a pretty badly blown call by the officials in last night's game. And I, you know, we'll never find out for sure, but you'd assume that those officials will be downgraded when their performance is evaluated as a result of blowing that call. So, two-part question for you. One, like Bruce Boudreau said post-game, did that cost the Wild the game?
How could you possibly say that cost them the game?
I didn't say it. Bruce Boudreau did.
Well, I'm just saying. I mean, there is...
The head coach of the Minnesota Wild believes...
Yeah, we all heard it, Drew. I mean, but there's absolutely no way that you could prove that. I mean, the call was missed.
Yeah.
Could it have had an impact on the game? Absolutely.
I'm surprised that Bruce Boudreau would... I mean... Look, he has every right to be upset, because I would be upset too as an NHL head coach. I found that his comments were veering from justifiably upset to being a little whiny, and I don't know how that's going to play in the dressing room and how that's going to play in terms of what the message you're sending to your team. Now, I saw Elliot Friedman last night after Boudreau's comment saying that he's just trying to set the stage for Game 5. And very well might be the case. He's trying to get the officials on his side ahead for Game 5. But to me, it veered away from using it as a motivational tool or veered away from using it as a way to game the system and maybe game the officials to... Woe is me, woe is us, everybody's got it out for us, it just sounded a little too whiny from my perspective to really like the sound of it from the Minnesota Wild perspective.
Yeah, it's a fair comment, and Bruce Boudreau and the rest of the Wild guys, they're frustrated, right? They're going back to Winnipeg down 3-1. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the series is over. We know when a team goes down 3-1, your chances of coming back are very slim, right, Drew? So I think that's a frustrated coach, and you know, you could say that it's whiny, but the reality is the Jets could have killed that penalty, right? They could have killed off the 5-on-3. We will never know, right? It's one of those things that...
It was a one-goal game up until with 10 seconds to go. So it's not like... You know, it's a huge missed call. I don't want to understate it. It's a huge missed call, and he has every right to be upset, and he has every right to think that the officials blew it, because they did. But to say that we lost the game because of a missed cross check,
no, the Jets outplayed the Wild. Devin Dubnyk's the only reason I think that's a one goal game late in the game.
I agree.
I mean, I think the Jets played better than the Wild, quite frankly, and I thought that Game 4 was probably the most even of the four games, Drew, because we know that Game 3, the Wild blew the Jets out 6-2, even though the score probably was more flattering to the Wild. We know that Game 2 was dominated by the Jets, and I think, quite frankly, Game 1 was dominated by the Jets.
Right.
So that was probably the most even of the four games, and yes, I agree. I mean, that is a huge missed call. The referees screwed up there, but there's nothing the Jets can do about it. And as far as I'm concerned, have the Jets not been screwed by the refs? Were they not screwed in that regular season game against Vegas when that goaltender interference penalty wasn't called on James Neal? I mean, that's an extra point for the Jets there in the regular season, and you never know. I mean, that point could have ended up being huge, and they could have ended up finishing first in the entire league. Obviously, they finished three behind Nashville, but my point is that calls have gone against the Jets as well.
Well, you compare and contrast how Paul Maurice handled the Tyler Myers injury and the... whether the questionable play by Marcus Foligno, and then you compare it to how Bruce Boudreau handled this one, and I just thought Boudreau came off a little too, like I said, whiny in his comments, and that it might have a detriment on the dressing room.
And it's funny because we saw Maurice respond to that somewhat today. You heard Boudreau, like you were saying, cost us the game, huge play, missed this, you know. But then you heard kind of Paul Maurice... reluctantly, he was prodded a bit today. He kind of took a breath and he went, yeah, well, Marcus Foligno ran Jacob Trouba and Nino Niederreiter headbutted Ben Chiarot. And
yeah, he got into it a little bit.
And he kind of let the guard down and he threw it right back in Boudreau's face. And now we've kind of seen the coaches, this tenacity seep into the bench.
And I think Sean makes a really good point there. I think you could make a strong argument that Marcus Foligno should get a game for that hit to the head on Jacob Trouba.
Okay, let's talk about the Morrissey hit then. As we're waiting for the Department of Player Safety to come out with a decision, whether that's a fine, whether that's no supplemental discipline, whether that's a game or two games. From your perspective, Mr. Ginsburg, what do you think Morrissey deserves for the cross-check on Eric Staal, if anything?
I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a game. I like Josh Morrissey. If you've listened to this show for the last 3 years, you know how much we like Josh Morrissey. He's probably, in my opinion, the Jets' best defenseman, and they're going to miss him if he doesn't play on Friday. But the reality is it's a cross-check to the head. He cross-checks Eric Staal in the head, and the refs miss it. And based on the way, you know, the NHL Department of Player Safety has called these types of incidents, he probably gets a game. But, you know, if he gets a game, I think Marcus Foligno should get a game for his hit to the head on Jacob Trouba. I actually think that play was worse.
Sean?
I think we're going to see a game just because it's the head area. It's so front and center. And it, you saw the pain that Eric Staal was in. He came back. He played well. He played hard. But the thing that's bothersome to me is that you look around, even just some of the plays that have taken place in the postseason, you got the Kopitar butt end to the face.
No supplemental discipline.
Nothing at all. You have PK Subban essentially sucker punching Nathan MacKinnon in the back of the head.
No supplemental discipline.
What about Victor Hedman spearing Nico Hischier in the balls?
Yeah, and then in the regular season...
Sorry, Drew, the nether regions.
You can call it the balls, it's fine. I think I understood what you were referencing.
And I could have said something a lot worse.
You could have.
Much worse. In the regular season, you have the Brad Marchand cross-check. I believe it was Andy McDonald in the Flyers. He cross-checks him in the face, and he gets fined. So... if there's no suspensions on some of those plays,
But you look at what has what I mean. Nazem Kadri got suspended for 3 games for running Tommy Wingles, mm-hmm. and then Drew Doughty got the 1 game suspension
the
as well.
The Doughty one is the one that everyone I think.
Breaking news, Drew: the NHL Department of Player Safety has just announced Josh Morrissey has been suspended for 1 game, so he won't play on Friday.
There you go. Breaking right now. Is that the right decision in your mind? And let me ask a second question to that effect. Is that decision made because the officials missed it on the ice and he didn't get penalized on the ice? If he gets a 5-minute major and maybe a game misconduct on the ice for his hit to Eric Staal, does he get supplemental discipline? Don't answer that yet. This is what we call a hook in the radio business. We come back on the other end of, on the other side of these breaks and we answer that question. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're talking about the Morrissey 1-game suspension just announced. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Could you tell us what you saw from your perspective on the hit on Eric Staal?
Yeah, I mean, complete accident. Trying to box out in front of net on the PK, and you know, he's a big guy, and my stick ended up getting up a little bit on him, and you know, would never try to do that to anybody. That's not a dirty player, I don't believe. And like I said, it was a complete accident. And you know, that's all I guess I could say is it was an accident.
That's Josh Morrissey, Joshua Morrissey, Jets defenseman, addressing the media following last night's game 4. His cross check to the head and neck of Eric Staal has just earned him a 1-game suspension. So the Jets will be without Joshua Morrissey for Friday's Game 5 between the Jets and the Wild. The Jets looking to clinch on home ice. One more time, in case you're just joining us, Joshua Morrissey, Winnipeg Jets defenseman, suspended for 1 game for his cross-check to the head and neck of Eric Staal. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth to ting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. I asked you guys before the break if Josh Morrissey gets suspended if the officials don't miss the call, meaning if they penalize him, 5-minute major, double minor, 5 in a game, whatever it might be. If they penalize him during game four, if they penalize him during game four, does he get the supplemental discipline that he just received?
Yeah, I think he still does get 1 game. And, you know, you asked us before the news broke, Drew, and based on the incident, I thought he should get a game. And that doesn't mean that Josh Morrissey meant to do it. And that doesn't mean that we don't think he's a great player. I mean, you have to take responsibility for your own actions. And it's the same thing if you get a high sticking penalty in a game and you didn't mean to do it. It's still a high sticking penalty. So Morrissey gets the stick up on Staal, and everyone saw it watching at home, but the refs missed it. So I think even if the refs penalized Morrissey on the play, Drew, he'd still get a 1-game suspension, because that Krawczyk was pretty bad. And, you know, the Jets are going to miss him in game five, but I still think the Jets are going to finish off this series in five games. What's really interesting, Drew, is who is going to replace Josh Morrissey on that top pair? Because Dmitry Kulikov, Toby Enstrom, Tyler Myers, all out of the lineup right now. The Jets reassigned Sammy Niku to the Manitoba Moose today.
Right.
But that's based on that.
That's likely a paper move, I suspect. They'll bring him practice, right back up. Yeah. They just give him practice today with
Talk
the
about
Moose.
Practice.
Right. So is Ben Chiarot your top pairing defenseman on the left side?
Well, it's Chiarot or it's Joe Morrow playing with Byfuglien. I mean, there's nobody else on the left side. I mean, maybe Toby Enstrom's ready. Hard to know if he's ready or not.
I don't think you're going to bring him into the lineup and put him on the top pair playing 20 to 25 minutes a game.
I expect that Byfuglien will still be paired with Joe Morrow. And, you know, I think you try to make as few changes as possible.
Right, but Jacob Trouba and Josh Morrissey, so who are you putting with Trouba is my question.
I think you put Chiarot there. Unless Enstrom's ready and feeling great, then you could put Enstrom with Trouba.
Maurice did say today that we may have to flip some guys. So yeah, they're not going to be reluctant to put maybe a couple of righties on the left side.
It would not surprise me in the least bit. I mean, the Jets will run. I mean, they played Tucker Pullman about 9 minutes last game last night against Minnesota. I expect his numbers will jump up a little bit, assuming Myers isn't back. If Myers is back, then you ride your right side hard for the one game and hope you don't have to worry about, you know, tiring your guys out for a game six or tiring them out for later games in the series. Sean, same question to you that I asked Ezzy. If they call it properly on the ice, is it a suspension for Joshua Morrissey?
No, I don't know what you guys are talking about, because then Minnesota goes, scores on the power play, scores another goal later on in the game, win the game, according to Bruce Boudreau.
And the series is tied, right?
Yeah, and there we go. Series is tied, so nothing to make of it. But yeah, I thought he was going to get disciplined just because he wasn't disciplined on the ice, and the NHL has to kind of make amends for missing such a call. We talked about this right before we came live on the segment, how much pain Eric Staal looked like he was in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that rocked his guy's world, and someone needs to pay for that. And you do have, like as he was saying, you got to be responsible for your stick, even if it's an accident. We see it all the time. And the refs, I thought the refs somewhat tried to make up for that call as the game went on. I'm not saying the calls were lopsided, but the Hellebuck tripping call or slashing call on Zucker.
I thought that was a penalty.
Thought so?
Yeah, I thought he got Zucker.
Got him on the hand, but did he need to dive head first?
Well, maybe they overlooked the Zucker dive, but I thought it was a penalty on Hellebuck still when that happened. I didn't think that was a Revlon call, as they used to say, a makeup call.
By the way, Dave Minuk is going to have to fix the tweet on the Illegal Curve Twitter account, because right now it says Josh Morrissey suspended one game for cross-checking Minnesota's Eric Steele.
Well, close enough. Steele, Staal, a little autocorrect, I think. Dave is not going to be happy with you for mentioning that on air, let me tell you. Interesting.
Well, the funniest thing is four people have already retweeted it.
Interesting tweet from a former NHLer in response to whether or not this should have been a suspendable offense. Mike Richards, who, of course, you remember as a member of the LA Kings and as a member of the Philadelphia Flyers.
The pride of Kenora. Yeah.
Said, you know, that Joshua Morrissey shouldn't get punished for the ref missing the call. It's a penalty, but not a suspension. So I thought that was an interesting perspective from a former player, as I truly believe. I mean, players themselves know what's worthy of a suspension and what's not.
Drew, I don't necessarily buy the NHL Department of Player Safety is suspending Morrissey because the call was missed.
But do you think it factored in?
It shouldn't have.
Maybe it shouldn't have, but do you think it did?
Well, I don't have the answer to that.
Okay,
I mean, you'll have to ask George Parros, and I'm not trying to be cute. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's a pretty vicious cross-check to the head of Staal. And the reality is, you can go back and you can listen all year long. I've been singing the praises of Morrissey. I think he's the Jets' best D-man. But the reality is, he gets the stick up on Staal, and it's a one-game suspension.
So let's talk about the ramifications for the Jets' defense, because they could very well be entering tomorrow night's game without Joshua Morrissey. We know that's for sure. Without Toby Enstrom, without Dmitry Kulikov, and without Tyler Myers. So you're down, you know, one of your right side defensemen and your three left side defensemen at the start of the year. Is this something the Jets can overcome in in that one game window?
Yes.
So this isn't a excuse for the team to not perform, in Game 5. They can't use this as a crutch for a poor performance in Game 5 in your perspective.
No, and Minnesota can't use, you know, not having Zach Parise and not having Ryan Suter. What's that, Sean? $15 million not playing in the lineup right now for the Wild?
I mean, it's a lot of millions.
You just can't use that as an excuse, and I still think the Jets can win Game 5 without Morrissey. I mean, if he's suspended for, you know, two or three games, I think that's a much bigger issue. If you don't have Morrissey, for example, in the second round, mm-hmm. early on in Nashville, right? We're expecting the Predators to win their round one series and then host the Jets in the second round, right? I mean, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, but I think, you know, one game you can overcome that, and, you know, we'll wait and see if Myers is ready to go here in Game 5. But as we talked about, I mean, you maybe have to move somebody from the right side to the left side. We've seen Tucker Poolman play on the left side. I mean, do you go with Tucker Poolman and Jacob Trouba, that All-American pair? I'm not sure, but I mean, I like Joe Morrow. I agree with you. Morrow and Buff have actually been really good there together. So
I think you want to make as few changes as you have to make.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, I mean, Morrow and Buff, there's no reason to change that pair. I mean, Morrow played, you know, he played, you know, 20 minutes last night, if I'm not mistaken. 17:59 last night. So he played a solid 18 minutes of hockey.
Drew, I think moving up Sherratt to that top pair makes a lot of sense with Jacob Trouba, and then you have Sammy Niku and Tucker Poolman playing together on that third pair. That's what makes the most sense to me.
If Myers is healthy, do you maybe move somebody to the left side and use Niku as your seventh defenseman, or do you keep the, you know, keep him on his strong side? You don't make somebody play out of position, and you say, you know, maybe there's no big difference between Sammy Niku and Tucker Poolman at this point. Let's say Myers is healthy.
Niku did play with Buff in Montreal, by the way.
Right, that one game end of the year. But if Poolman is, let's say Myers is healthy, and we really don't know his status for tomorrow, but if Myers is back in, do you maybe consider putting Niku on the left side because he is a left-handed shot, and not worry about moving Poolman from his right side to his left side, or Myers or Trouba or whomever to their off wing, where it's much harder to play as a defenseman.
Agreed, but didn't Poolman get some time on the left side, possibly near the beginning of the year?
And I don't think it went very well.
Right.
And now you're talking about doing so during the game five of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
In the biggest game of the season, essentially.
I think Sean, Drew makes a good point there. I wouldn't be surprised if Trouba moves from the right side to the left side. I mean, we know that he has played a little bit on the mm-hmm. left side, and that was an issue for him prior to signing that two-year deal with the Jets. So maybe, Drew, you move Trouba to the left side, and then your top pair becomes Trouba and Tyler Myers, if he's healthy, but that all, you know, depends on if Myers is ready to go.
All eyes.
Or Trouba and Buff.
Sure. I mean, I think you keep Buff and Morrow together as much as possible. I mean, I just don't see any reason not to. I think it'll certainly be a fascinating morning skate for Paul Maurice and the Winnipeg Jets tomorrow, and it'll be especially interesting because, you know, usually on game days as of late, they've been having optionals. So you might not be able to read anything into the Winnipeg Jets lineup or know anything officially about the Jets lineup until right before puck drop tomorrow night as to who's going to be playing on the defense. Imagine if you see Toby Enstrom on the ice, if he chooses to skate during an optional skate, if he's available to skate during an optional skate. I mean, you know, this Enstrom injury has sort of been underplayed because when the Jets shut him down, you know, with a few weeks to go in the regular season, the expectation was, I mean, Paul Maurice at the time said, we're getting him ready for the playoffs. And then game one came and went, and he hadn't been on the ice, and he didn't play, and now game two, and now game three, and now game four. Well, now you're in a situation where, holy hell, you need Toby Enstrom if he's only, you know, 85% healthy, way more than you did when you had Morrissey in your lineup.
And just real quick before we go to break, just something that Paul Maurice has said a lot down the stretch is Toby Enstrom's pain threshold and what he's been able to play through. So I wouldn't be too surprised if maybe they've been keeping him on the bike and just doing his little solo workouts, and maybe if they really need someone, they plug him in for a game and just see what happens.
It's possible. It'll be very interesting. Obviously, if you're just joining us one more time, Joshua Morrissey suspended for one game for Friday night's Game 5 as a result of the cross-check to the head and neck area of Eric Staal. We'll know more.
What about Eric Steele?
Well, that's a separate issue altogether. We'll know more about the Jets' defense the next 24 to 48 hours. Puck drop is exactly 48 hours from now, 6:30 p.m. on Friday night, a game you can hear live, of course, on TSN 1290. When we come back, we're going to be joined by John Mattis of Post Media. We'll talk about the suspension. We'll talk about the Jets Wild. We'll talk about the playoffs as a whole with John. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
Wednesday evening, bottom of the hour, you're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to be joined by John Mattis of Post Media. John, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Our pleasure, John. We'll obviously get into the Bruins and the Leafs series with you and the playoffs as a whole. But, of course, the talk here in Winnipeg is about the suspension that was just handed down to Joshua Morrissey for one game for his cross-check to the head and neck area of Eric Staal. John, the question I want to ask you, though, is if the officials call it properly on the ice, I just asked this question to Ezra and Sean in the previous segment. If the officials call it properly on the ice and Morrissey gets, you know, 5 minutes and five in a game, do you think he gets supplemental discipline as well?
That's a tough one. I doubt it. And if I was making the call, I would probably not in that scenario. Just because where it was on the ice, how Morrissey doesn't have a track record, how you could tell he wasn't, you know, there was no intent there to injure Staal. Obviously, you know, the end result was pretty ugly. It looked like it definitely hurt. It definitely, you know, required some sort of discipline. But if it had been five in a game right there, I think that would have done it. But I'm glad that they did hand down some kind of suspension, because I don't know how, but the refs completely missed that, even though it was, like, in plain view and you know, Staal reacted. It's not like he took it and skated away. So kind of an odd situation, but I think it all sort of evens up in terms of discipline and the actual play itself.
John, we want to ask you more about the Jets Wild series. Wanted to ask you about the Toronto Boston series. It looked like the Maple Leafs were done. They come up with that big victory in game number three. Austin Matthews scores the game winning goal. But watching that game, for me, the story was Patrick Marleau picks up a couple of goals in that game, and we know how good he's been over the years in the playoffs with the San Jose Sharks, but is this exactly why the Leafs acquired Marleau in the offseason?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I think it's an overpay unless he, you know, scores the game-winning goal in the Stanley Cup final just based on his salary. But if you want to live with what they did and you want to look at it from Lou Lamoriello's perspective, he's pretty much done what you would want from him. He had a pretty good regular season, almost 30 goals. And then in the postseason, you know, watch him when he scores a goal. He doesn't celebrate. He will for about a second. He'll, you know, yell out or cheer or whatever. But then it's just back to business, because that guy's been there, done that. And even though he doesn't have that elusive ring, there's just like sort of an aura around him that, you know, he's nothing really phases him. And that, you know, you saw it in game three. He was the guy who is he necessarily going to drive a line? Is he necessarily going to take over a game individually? No, but he's going to be a guy that when he's fed a pass and there's the chance right there, it's going in the back of the net. He's very dependable in that way. And I think that you hit the nail on the head there, where as much as there was a lot going on in that game, it was a back and forth and high octane and all that. Marleau was kind of steady Eddie and he really helped them get through, and obviously going down 3-0 would have been disastrous. So full marks to Marleau, and it's making Lou Lamoriello look pretty smart.
John, a real good sign for the Boston Bruins. Not only is that top line just, you know, absolutely dominant right now, just putting up some ridiculous numbers, but a real good rookie showcasing of the, you know, a DeBrusk and a Vetrano and, you know, some younger guys that just are really showcasing their skills right now.
Yeah. They ended up finishing the regular season atop the rookie scoring list among teams, which is pretty surprising when their top scorer was Dayton Heinen, when their best rookie is Charlie McAvoy, who was a fantastic rookie, but was injured for a bit of it. And then they had Jake DeBrusque. Like, the thing about this rookie group on the Bruins is that aside from Charlie McAvoy, who I think anyone who watches hockey knows is a special player and is already a number one defenseman or at least, you know, 1B, aside from him, the other guys are just sort of sprinkled around the lineup. You know, you mentioned DeBrusque, the power forward that in game three took over an entire sequence and bodies flying off of him and sets up Krejci on the doorstep who doesn't end up scoring, but it just showed his power game and his sort of ceiling. And then, you know, you have Sean Corrali, who has quietly put up 3 points, isn't playing much. He's on the fourth line, but is being deployed in a defensive role and contributing and also able to kill penalties and just be it's funny because he's 25, so I was going to say, you know, be a guy that's kind of playing beyond his years, but he's a non-traditional rookie in that sense. But it's kind of an underrated story of the season, this group that they have in Boston, the first-year players, because, you know, there's no Matt Barzal. There's not even, you know, a Nolan Patrick or a Nico Hischier. These really, like, you know, heralded name-brand guys. There's just a bunch of guys getting it done and Charlie McAvoy.
John Mattis is our guest on NHL This Week. John is with the National Post and Post Media. John, PK Subban says that he'd sucker punch Nathan MacKinnon again if given the opportunity. Any problems with PK's comments and the initial sucker punch, as it were?
It was a weird. The thing is, some defensemen sort of check with their forearms, and that ends up sort of being their fist sometimes. And you see it a lot, and it's always sort of irked me where it's like, how is that legal? And Subban's one of those guys. I don't know really how they get away with it, but at the same time, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not, it doesn't look like it's hurting anyone or that it's too egregious. But with Subban, I thought the hit was a little dirty, but nothing, you know, to get suspended over, I don't think. But for him to say, you know, I wouldn't mind doing it again, that's his prerogative. And to be honest, from a media perspective, I like it. A couple of guys speaking their mind. You know, you have it in a couple other series, too, with some gamesmanship. Drew Doughty comes to mind. So I'm fine with that. But I guess it's one of those things where you don't want to test it if you're PK Subban in terms of the referees, because they're going to hear about that comment, or even the player safety. They're going to hear about that comment. And maybe, you know, when push comes to shove and these humans are making judgment calls on a suspension or on just a penalty in a game, you maybe get the short end of the stick. So interesting move by Subban, but at the same time, it's him, it's his personality, and I wouldn't want him to really change.
John, Lars Eller gets the big double overtime goal yesterday for Washington, and they avoid going down 3-0. And when you think back to, you know, at the beginning of the playoffs, everybody was looking forward to Boston, Toronto, and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. But is it possible that this is actually turning out to be the best series with all three games going to overtime so far?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I didn't necessarily think it was going to be, like, super entertaining, but this was one of the series. I think it was Toronto and Boston, Columbus and Washington, that I knew they would both go seven games, or I thought they would both go seven games, and I thought they were both sort of toss-ups. And if you think to Washington and Columbus, I mean, from Columbus's perspective, it's been Artemi Panarin, Seth Jones, and Bobrovsky just carrying them right now. No matter what game it is, they've been solid. They've been contributing, especially Panarin, at least from a visual perspective. When he's on his game, when he's playing at his peak, he's just a thrill to watch, and he's really been what this Blue Jackets team has needed for years is a game breaker. But the thing about the Capitals is not only could they have gone down 3-0 if they had lost in overtime, but they started the series not knowing who their goaltender was going to be, which I think is a huge red flag in the playoffs. I think that's not only a distraction, you know, externally, but internally in terms of the goalies looking over their shoulders. I mean, they end up choosing Grubauer to start, and now it's Holtby, which I think is fine. You know, if you want to make a change in series, that's fine. But I felt like coming in to the first round, having that sort of cloud over their heads was a bad omen, I guess you could say. And now Holtby's in there, and maybe he can steer the ship, because it is only 2-1 now. But, I mean, does anyone have any faith in the Washington Capitals in the playoffs? I don't know if you could find anyone except for maybe the guys in the room right now.
John, I'm wondering, how did Thomas Pekanec look in his increased role with Leo Komarov out from Game 3?
He looked pretty good. He looked about what he should have been looking like since he came over from Montreal. He's been, I wouldn't say like a huge disappointment, but he's been just sort of there. He hasn't been impactful. And mind you, Plekanec wasn't acquired to blow the doors off of the games that he ends up playing in, but supposed to be a contributor, supposed to be reliable defensively. And he had been very quiet. But he did, step up in game three. And also, you know, we talk about, that key matchup between the Bergeron line and the Matthews line, or however those two lines, end up on the ice against. But if you go down the lineup, I mean, the Toronto fourth line in game three was actually very good, with Moore in between, Kapanen and Janssen. So Toronto, although they got outplayed, and although Pasternak almost, you know, changed the game until that amazing save by Anderson at the end there with his stick, you know, a save of the year candidate. Before that happened, I mean, Boston was outplaying them. So Toronto didn't necessarily have a marquee or a poster showing in game three. And I think when it comes down to Plekanec, he still needs to get a little bit better.
John, last question for you. The first series ended last night with the Golden Knights sweep of the Los Angeles Kings. Sort of a two-part question for you. One, did we underestimate the Golden Knights? We, the general public, underestimate the Golden Knights yet again in thinking that the Kings might have even been the favorite in this series? And secondly, what did you make of Drew Doughty's interesting comments, you know, talking about shutting down the Carlson line and that they haven't really been that good, and that was the only goal that they had, which proved to be the game-winning goal in Game 3? I thought Drew Doughty's comments throughout the series were kind of odd, given that his team got swept.
Yeah, good point. The first part of that, I picked them to win this series. It's not a sweep. I don't think there's anyone out there. There might have been one person that placed money down in Vegas, and it is getting pretty rich right now. But I don't think anyone went for the sweep. I think some people went for the win for Vegas. I thought that the way that they're built is kind of the opposite of the Kings in terms of playing style. So, you know, you sort of think it's going to break one way or the other. So I wasn't completely surprised, but again, it's the Vegas Golden Knights. None of this makes sense overall. They're not supposed to make the playoffs. They weren't supposed to win their division. None of that. And then now they've won a playoff series. And it's, you know, depending on who they end up facing, but let's say they face San Jose, I don't think that's necessarily San Jose's series to just, you know, grasp or take out of the Vegas's, and I think it'll still be a very good series. It's just the way that the Western Conference and the playoff structure is. Vegas's, you know, run here through the first two rounds isn't against necessarily powerhouse teams. So, but to get to your Drew Doughty comment, a little strange, in terms of, what he said and not really having, the actions to back up his words. He also obviously, wasn't happy with the suspension. So, he kind of took the approach that he would be very honest with the media during the series, and I don't know if he was playing games or if he was just like, you know, didn't really care to sugarcoat anything, but it didn't end up working out on the ice, and I wouldn't say that's necessarily Doughty's fault. I didn't think he had a bad series. I didn't think he had an excellent series, somewhere in the middle there, but in the end, you know, sort of he talked the talk but didn't walk the walk in terms of his team advancing. So I'd say maybe it's a lesson learned for him. I don't know. He was sort of just being himself. This isn't the first time that Doughty has been outspoken. But at the same time, I don't know if it added some fuel to the fire for the Golden Knights, who, again, have been counted out countless times this year. The expansion draft alone was sort of a huge motivating factor, all these guys being cast aside. So you add Doughty sort of giving bulletin board material, and just another, you know, reason to get up for games.
John Mattis covers the NHL for Post Media. He's a good friend of the program. John, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Take care, John. We'll do it again real soon. When we come back, we look at the Eastern Conference playoff matchups. A couple of games are underway right now. We'll give you an update, talk about what's going on in the East. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
As volleyball back and forth, they will surround Matt Murray. They defeat the Philadelphia Flyers 5-1, and they lead the best-of-seven series 2-1.
Sidney Crosby, number one, four-point game. Matt Murray, we talked a lot about it, rightfully so. So good when his team was struggling early.
Penguins take game three between themselves and the Philadelphia Flyers. Game four currently underway right now. Look at the Eastern Conference playoff matchups. Welcome back to NHL This Week, the segment brought to you by Keener Jerseys. Specializing in customization services and branded team apparel, Keener Jerseys is changing the game with world-class craftsmanship and unparalleled service. If you want awesome jerseys for your rec team, or have a jersey you want personalized, visit KeenerJerseys.com or check out their showroom at 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. Tell them that Illegal Curve sent you. Before we get into the Eastern Conference playoff races, I mentioned earlier about Mike Richards' tweet, former NHL player, saying that, you know, the Morrissey hit should not have been worthy of a suspension. It should have been, you know, they missed the penalty on the ice. Upon finding out that Morrissey had been suspended for one game, Mike Richards tweeted that that's a joke by the NHL. So, interesting perspective from a former player. Hear what they have to say. Not Mike Richards in this instance, not agreeing with the one-game suspension handed out to Joshua Morrissey for his cross-check into the head and neck region of Eric Staal. Couple Eastern Conference series underway tonight in Philadelphia, where the Penguins look to take a 3-1 series lead. After 20 minutes, they lead the Flyers 2-0. Evgeny Malkin, his third of the playoffs. Phil Kessel, his first of the playoffs. 2-0 for the Penguins. They look like they're well on their way to taking a 3-1 lead in that series, Ezzy.
Yeah, and there's a couple of periods left here, Drew, but you know, it's tough to go down 2-0, especially with the way Matt Murray has been playing in this series. And you know, Sean Couturier is not playing tonight. And you know, it was just a couple of hours ago, Drew, that Sean Couturier actually got his first ever Selke Trophy nomination.
Yes.
Patrice Bergeron and Andrei Kopitar, guys that are very familiar to being the Selke Trophy finalists and winners. No surprise there, but Sean Couturier, a player who has been in the conversation for the Selke Trophy, Sean, you know, for many years now, and he finally, you know, gets a nomination. Well, I was going to say, without Couturier in the lineup tonight, I mean, that's a big blow. Drew, Couturier leads the Flyers with 3 points in three games. He goes
number one center.
Exactly, and he goes up against the Crosby line. And, you know, he's been averaging, I think, 24 and a half minutes of ice time. I don't know what's beeping right now, but unless somebody's baking a cake here in the studio.
Rory's cell phone, don't worry. He's just getting some messages.
Popular
guy, producer Rory is, you know.
And let's be honest, guys. And that's for Cementhead, who says that I say let's be honest too much.
Yeah.
The Flyers are just not as good as the Penguins. It's as simple as that. And, you know, give them a lot of credit. They get the big Game 3 win there. But,
Game 2 win.
Game 2 win.
Yeah.
But we know that if you go down 2-0 back to Philadelphia, I mean, it's just impossible to come back down 2-0. The stats are just not in your favor, right? So, I mean, really impressive that they were able to win a game in this series. I don't think anybody thought that the Flyers were going to win this series.
Yeah.
So, you know, just a really tough situation. Winnipeg's Nolan Patrick, in his rookie year, he's playing on the top line there. Instead of moving Claude Giroux from wing to center, they decide to go with Patrick. But you just don't have the center depth to compete against the Penguins, who have Crosby, Malkin, Broussard.
Yeah. Oh, Radko Gudas, I mean, if you missed it, what happened, Couturier and Radko Gudas clipped skates in a warm-up drill, or in a practice drill yesterday. Gudas was skating backwards. He doesn't see Couturier. Couturier's in the midst of another drill. He comes in. He doesn't see Gudas. They collide. And it's one of those things that, you know,
It's a
freak accident.
And it's really unfortunate.
It really is. I mean, as soon as you saw it and you saw that Couturier doesn't bounce back, you know, quickly from that, you know, okay, something's seriously wrong. Because, you know, anytime you go down in practice, if you're not getting up quickly, you know, and a guy like Sean Couturier, who's really heart and soul of the Philadelphia Flyers and has blossomed into a top line center after being mainly only thought of as a defensive specialist. Mm-hmm. Now he's putting up the offensive numbers
And the Penguins are playing tonight without Patrick Hornquist, Drew.
Right.
And Dominic Simone is actually playing on the top line with Jake Gensel and Crosby. So, I mean, you can't use that as an excuse, but when you're the Flyers and you already don't have the forward depth that the Penguins have, yeah. I mean, you just can't, I think, make up for that.
Sidney Crosby against Nolan Patrick, I mean, and all due respect to, I mean, Nolan Patrick's 18 years old. It's
right.
Just, I mean, that's a miss. I mean, Sidney Crosby against most anybody is a mismatch.
Yeah.
Sidney Crosby against an 18-year-old is an epic mismatch. And so that partly explains why the Penguins are up 2-0 through the first period in Philadelphia. It's looking like the Penguins should advance in that series fairly handily, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And, you know, we talked about it, you know, at the beginning of this series, the Couturier-Giroux line was not only going to have to shut down whether it was the Crosby or Malkin line, they were going to have to outscore that line. And Matt Murray has outplayed Brian Elliott, quite simply. So if you're going down 3-1 back to Pittsburgh, it's just a really gargantuan task to ask them to come back and win this series. There's a good chance the series could be over in 5, Drew.
Yeah, the Flyers needed to have superlative goaltending in this series for it to be competitive, and they simply haven't got it. I mean, you lose 7-0 in game one. You come back and you get a great game two victory, and then you go home in front of the rowdies in Philadelphia, and the Penguins dominate game three, and they're well on their way to dominating game four as well.
The best part about the opening game beatdown by the Penguins was Claude Giroux's post-game interview when they asked him what the difference was, and he goes, yeah, they made plays.
they made
some plays all right, Claude.
Understatement of the week right there. Other game that's underway, game four between the Tampa Bay Lightning and the New Jersey Devils. The Devils took game three after the Lightning won both games on home ice. You know, I think the scores maybe were not quite indicative as to how close the games were. The first two games that Tampa won were closer than the scores showed. Game three that the Devils win, well, they get their first bite at home ice in the series, and they have a good performance. Now, this is a big game four, clearly. I mean, Tampa Bay goes up 3-1 here. I'd suggest the series is over. But when it's a best of three, anything could happen in that. I mean, Tampa Bay was an offensive dynamo through the first two games, a little less so last night. And how about that? Well, we're talking about it right now. Boom. The Devils open the scoring. They're up 1-0 now on the Lightning about halfway through the first period. That would, Devils are all of a sudden, if it goes 2-2, then it's anybody's ballgame.
Yeah, I've got a bigger smile on my face right now, guys, for sure. But, I mean, the story for me in the series has to be the goaltending, similar to the Washington-Columbus series.
Sure.
I mean, at the beginning of the season, if the Devils were to make the playoffs, you'd think, okay, well,
Corey
Schneider is going to be your number one goalie. Keith Kincaid was absolutely awful in game two. He was horrible, and Corey Schneider has to come in, and he played really well in Game 3, and, you know, we're very familiar with Schneider, obviously, being a former member of the Moose here, and, you know, it's going to be interesting. The Devils have an opportunity here to tie the series up, and obviously we're about 10 minutes into the game here, Drew, but...
It was a 5-on-3 power play goal, so the power play continues for the Devils, so, that looked like a
Kyle Palmieri with the one-time blast.
Well, there you go. So, I mean, the Devils have an opportunity here to, maybe jump out to a lead. David Putty from Seinfeld was in the building, and he revved up the crowd in New Jersey by doing his old "We're the Devils" routine from the famous Seinfeld episode. Had the face painted, had a big D on his chest. So anytime you can see David Putty getting into it, you know things are going well.
The biggest difference for me, guys, between last year's Devils and this year's Devils is the mobility of their defense. Will Butcher was phenomenal in Game 3. Sammy Vatanen, we know he came over in the trade from Anaheim, Drew, but this Devils team is fast and skilled, and I'm not saying that the Devils are going to win this series here. The Lightning are still up 2-1, but that's the biggest difference watching this team play. I mean, Will Butcher kind of reminds me a little bit of Brian Rafalski, if you remember him from back in the day, won a Stanley Cup with the Devils back in 2003. I think he actually won two. He might have won one in 2000 as well, but, I mean, that's the biggest difference, and, you know, they're getting the goaltending, at least they got the goaltending in Game 3 from Corey Schneider, but it's still going to be tough for them to win this series, because you're still talking about, I think, the best offensive team in the league in the Lightning.
Well, it certainly would be a significant upset if the Tampa Bay Lightning were to lose in the first round after they were, really the best team in the NHL for a lot of the regular season. You know, sort of things slowed down a little bit towards the end of the year, but that's to be expected after they were home and cooled for so long.
How about Mikhail Sergachev in game three going toe-to-toe with Brian Boyle?
Yeah.
A little intense
and
stare.
Boyle, yeah. maybe a little intemperate with his words, threatening to take Sergachev's life. But that's all fair. All's fair in love and war and the Stanley Cup playoffs. A quick note and a quick NHL Winnipeg Jets note as before we go to break. On the panel in the intermission, Ron McLean says he hears that Tyler Myers will be good to go for the Jets on Friday night. Take that for what it's worth, but maybe some good news for the Jets defense, a defense that's going to be without Joshua Morrissey. But maybe, according to Ron McLean, he hears that Myers might be ready to go Friday night for the Jets.
Just a quick note, Drew. I was comparing Will Butcher to Brian Rafalski. Rafalski did win a cup in 2000. I believe that was his first year with the Devils. I wasn't sure. I knew.
So he won two cups?
Yeah, I knew that he won the cup in 2003, but, that's 18 years ago, so that's a long time ago.
You are our Devils savant.
That's many, many, many beers ago.
Yeah, many, many moon ago for you too there, young man. When we come back, Aaron Portsline of TheAthletic.com in Columbus is going to join us. We'll talk about the Blue Jackets Capital Series. There's been plenty of overtime, and the Caps finally won an overtime game last night. Aaron Portsline joins us next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Sean Assor. You can follow us on Twitter @IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com in Columbus, Ohio, we're pleased to welcome back to the program our good friend Aaron Portsline. Aaron, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, good evening. Thanks for having me.
Brought you on to talk about the Blue Jackets Capital Series. A couple overtime games in the three games that we've had so far. You know, Blue Jackets, home ice hasn't meant anything in the series so far, but that win last night for the Washington Capitals, it really does sort of reset the series and gets everything, even though it's not quite even. I think it goes back to being anybody's ball game with game four set to be played in the next couple days.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if Columbus wins that game, then you're talking about them maybe closing it out on Thursday. And what does that say about this collection of Capitals players if they get closed out and swept in the first round? Right? I mean, that changes the whole, I think, outlook and tenor of that organization. Certainly Barry Trotz's future there. It's different now. I mean, that's what's great about the playoffs, right? One win can change the mood around the whole thing. I still think Columbus, certainly on paper, has the upper hand. I still think they have their best game in them yet. They haven't played anywhere close to that. I thought, actually, Tuesday's game was maybe their best game of the series, and it's the one that they lose. So it's kind of a weird series. All three games to overtime. Who could have banked on that? I don't think the Capitals have played their best either. It's still sort of like a three or four game feeling out process. But I would suggest that Thursday's game is probably going to take it to another level for one of these two teams, and then truly the series resets yet again.
Aaron, I think I speak for everyone when I say that I hope we see another three overtime games in this series. You know, everyone's talking about how well Artemi Panarin has been playing, not only in these playoffs, but this season for the Blue Jackets. But the player who's impressed me the most, and I wouldn't be surprised if you agree with me, Aaron, is Pierre-Luc Dubois. And, you know, he had a good rookie season for the Blue Jackets, but is this maybe his coming out party here in the playoffs?
Yeah, well, I think it's such a grand stage. I think if you play in Columbus, sometimes it's hard to grab national or certainly continental headlines, if you will. But in the playoffs, that's not a problem. And, you know, he has been just, it's hard to overstate, frankly, what he has meant to this franchise this year. If you think about all of the struggles they've had, not just offensively, but specifically down the middle, where Wenberg was supposed to be their number one center. He's fought injuries this year. He's fought long stretches of ineffectiveness. He's out of the lineup now with an injury. He fell down. Brandon Dubinsky has had a really rough season. They lost William Karlsson, who's had a pretty good year for Vegas in the expansion draft. If Pierre-Luc Dubois was not ready to play and be a difference maker, there's no way that this team is in the playoffs. They're just not. And his 200-foot game, dare I say, soaring confidence as the season has moved on, has them really excited about where this kid can get to in the not-too-distant future. He looks like a special player.
Aaron, does Jarmo Kekalainen maybe give himself a pat on the back sometimes when he sees how well Dubois is playing, and he kind of goes back to that 2016 draft and a pretty, I don't want to say criticized, but a pretty interesting selection to take the centerman Dubois over Jesse Puljujärvi?
Yeah, no, you can say criticized because it was. The draft is such an interesting thing. Usually the hardest opinions come from the people who have seen the fewest of these players play, right? And it's not exciting, but I tend to try to hold back judgment on these things. If anything, I respect a team that is willing to go up on the stage and take the boos, which they got boos, get the sort of the critical look at their draft the day after, as long as they feel like they're doing the right thing and taking the guy that they want. And to heck with anybody else's opinions. I can think back to the early days of this franchise when the Blue Jackets would have been served very well to do that very same thing instead of going off their own board and trying to appease people based upon somebody else's list. It was an unusual move. It was a surprise to a lot of people who are draft experts, but there was something with Pierre-Luc Dubois, many things with Pierre-Luc Dubois that the Blue Jackets really liked, and there were a few things with Puljujärvi that concerned them. And so far, I think we can say they made the right pick.
Aaron Portsline is our guest on NHL This Week. Aaron covers the Columbus Blue Jackets for TheAthletic.com in Columbus. Aaron, you know, how nice is it for John Tortorella and for the Blue Jackets management to have that stabilizing force in Ian Cole on the blue line? Certainly not flashy, certainly not going to get the headlines, but just having that steady veteran back there, how important has that been for the Blue Jackets?
Yeah, it's been important, and really he's filling the role that last year was filled by Jack Johnson and David Savard, formed a really good defensive pair. Really solid. And, I mean, look at Jack Johnson's career plus minus numbers for what that's worth are minus well into the triple digits before last season. And he and Savard were both really, really substantially plus players. And now it's Cole that's taken that spot. And Savard's game's gotten better. They now have some, you know, a defensive pair, a physical pair that they can roll out there against top line. And Jack Johnson, by the way, still on this roster, not in the lineup. But I think it goes beyond that with Cole just on the ice stuff. Obviously, he's won the last two Stanley Cups with Pittsburgh. It's a team that they may face in the second round if they're fortunate enough to get past the first round. But he has been to places that nobody else on this roster has been. And he is also very engaging, very talkative. I think leadership comes really easy to him. And you get on the other side of the trade deadline and you see how he's fit in, Bannock has fit in, Letestu has fit in here in his second tour with Columbus. All of these moves, talk about Jarmo Kekalainen patting himself on the back, all of these moves are worthy of that because it's really helped beef things up here.
Aaron, Alex Wennberg played in Game 1, but he didn't play in Game 2 or Game 3 with that upper body injury. Is there a chance that we could see him play in Game 4? And how important is he for the Blue Jackets if they want to go on a long run here?
Yeah, I don't get any sense that he's available for Game 4, though that could change if they're ranked tomorrow if he skates. It's a big loss for them. Wennberg didn't have the best season, but his last month and a half, like so many other veterans on this team, really, really came on strong. And the addition to at the trade deadline of Thomas Vanek has given the Blue Jackets, really for the first time all year, a second line with Jenner on the left, Vanek on the right, and Wennberg in the middle. Ever since he's been out, that line has kind of dried up a bit. And that has to be a worry for them because, you know, Washington is getting a lot of power plays, scoring a lot of power play goals. It might take four goals to win these games the way that this series has been going. And I'm not sure that it will be easy for them to get there if Vanek's not rolling, if that second line isn't engaging. Nick Foligno's moved up in that spot, not a perfect fit, and it hasn't been as productive. I do think Wennberg, losing him, not just in even strength, but also in the power play, it could be a bigger move than some people realize.
Aaron, one of my favorite parts of the postseason is the exposure to some of the players, you know, that we don't get to watch throughout the regular season as much as we'd like. And is it fair to say that Artemi Panarin has shed the shadow of Patrick Kane, and this guy is just showing the world what a true stud he really is?
I think that is fair to say. Yeah, I think he's actually shed a couple of I don't want to call them stigmas, but question marks for sure. Can he play without Patrick Kane? He had an unbelievable season this year with a rookie centerman to his right, with, you know, a couple of different wingers on his far right. He has taken this team on his back as an offensive player and has just been absolutely dynamic. The last eight games, he's got 20 points. He's got multiple points in all three playoff games. Not only has he shed the Patrick Kane issue, but I also think he has shed this idea that he can't play in the playoffs, which started to crop up last year with Chicago when they were swept in the first round by Nashville. He can play in the playoffs. He has been a dynamic player for the Blue Jackets in the playoffs. There, as I said of Dubois earlier, the Blue Jackets are nowhere near the playoffs with Panarin, and they're certainly not up 2-1 without Panarin. That game-winning overtime goal in the first game was a huge lift for this franchise.
Last one for you, Aaron, and we appreciate your time this evening. Sure. Obviously, all three games, the first three games, went to overtime, which shows you how close this series is with, you know, the game four set for tomorrow and then every second day after that. What's going to be the determining factor over who wins the remainder of this series? Is it just that close between these two teams, or is there an X factor that you think is going to still rear its head?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a hard read, frankly, for me, because I think there have been things about Columbus's game that you like. They've taken too many penalties, but Sergei Bobrovsky looks like a postseason goaltender. For the first time, he's really struggled in the playoffs until this year. Now he looks like his best self, which I think is really good news for this team. And yet, they're up 2-1 in the series. Of the entire span of playing time now through three games, all that have gone to overtime, really the equivalent of four games, Columbus has had the lead in this series for just over 17 minutes. The rest of it has either been tied or Washington has had the lead for almost 80 minutes of it. They've been the better team, and Columbus has been chasing, not chasing the play necessarily, but it constantly in come-from-behind mode. I think that's the next step for them, is to dictate in this series. I think if they continue to chase the play and chase the score against Washington, I think this thing could turn around quickly. They have to stay out of the penalty box. They've given up a power play goal in every game they've played against the Capitals this year, regular season and postseason. That has to be cleaned up. There's a lot of things they can fix, but I think there's also a lot of things that they've done very well, and it's already been their most competitive playoff series as a franchise. So progress of a sort, but I think they'd like to take it a step further.
Aaron Portsline covers the Columbus Blue Jackets for TheAthletic.com in Columbus. The Blue Jackets lead the Washington Capitals 2-1. Game four goes tomorrow night back in Columbus. Aaron, appreciate your time this evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Aaron. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Calgary Flames' search for a new head coach and potential supplemental discipline coming to Nikita Kucherov. We'll tell you about it. It just happened. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Well, I think any time you're in a position like we are today and you're making a coaching change, there's blood on a lot of hands. And it starts with the manager. I'm in charge of the team, so we're all accountable for underperformance.
Brad for living should probably wash his hands if he's got blood all over them.
I thought he said there's blood on Monahan's. I was like, what?
No. There's blood on a lot of hands. It was a firing kind of week in Calgary. Glenn Gullitson and a couple of assistant coaches dismissed from the Calgary Flames organization after a tremendously disappointing year in Calgary. That was Brad for living, Flames general manager, talking about the decision. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment brought to you by Bernstein's Deli, official deli of Illegal Curve Hockey and home of the Illegal Curve Sandwich. Located in the Cordon Village Mall, Bernstein's Deli has been Winnipeg's deli destination for nearly 30 years. For more information, find them on Facebook or at bernsteinsdeli.com. Remember, if you're looking for a place to catch the game, Bernstein's Deli's got you covered. They got the great big screen TVs. They've got great food and drink specials. It's hashtag Hockey Night at Bernstein's. For more information, bernsteinsdeli.com. Glenn Gullitson dismissed as Calgary Flames head coach. Not really a surprise. We thought that this was going to happen when the Flames season ended just as poorly as it did. From your perspective, Mr. Ginsburg, what kind of coach do the Flames need to go with now? They got a lot of talent on the team. Underachieving. You hear a lot of rumors, a lot of scuttlebutt that the dressing room isn't great.
Pittsburgh just went up 3-0, by the way, so this series is over.
That the dressing room isn't right in Calgary. So who do they need to bring in to rectify things in Calgary?
I'll tell you this much, Drew.
Yeah.
It wasn't the big boys that didn't get it done, because Sean Monahan, Johnny Gaudreau, and Matthew Tkachuk, they all had career years.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't the big horses for the Flames. It was the secondary scoring. That was, for me, the biggest problem with the Flames this year. As far as who is going to be the replacement for Glenn Gullitson, the name you keep hearing is Bill Peters, right? And Bill Peters does have an opt-out clause, Drew,
He's currently the Carolina Hurricanes head coach, but he does have an opt-out clause.
Right, and for those who don't know, Bill Peters and Brad Treliving have a relationship previous to this year with Hockey Canada at the World Hockey Championship.
Right.
Team Canada won gold, Brad Treliving and Bill Peters, so that's kind of the connection there. There's also a connection between Brad Treliving and Dave Tippett. Dave Tippett was the longtime coach of the Arizona Coyotes. Treliving was the assistant GM there with Maloney.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is a history there with Dave Tippett as well. You hear that maybe it didn't end so well with Maloney and Tippett. But other names you're hearing, Sean, Daryl Sutter's name has been mentioned, maybe going back to Calgary.
Indeed. Viking Alberta. I mean, it makes sense. He's a hell of a head coach.
Peters is from Alberta as well.
Peters is from Alberta as well. I mean, Daryl Sutter's always going to be linked to Alberta coach openings just by the proximity of, the Sutter family ranch?
Yes.
He could just hop on the old tractor and go to the rink.
And Daryl Sutter's a beauty. I'm not sure if, you know, the Flames want to bring him back, but L.A. Vigneault makes a lot of sense for me.
That's the one I was thinking.
And, Sean, I'm not sure if they decide to go with Alain Vigneault, but Brad Treliving has said that they want a coach with experience. And we know that Vigneault has the experience, not just with the Rangers, but he has the experience with the Canucks as well. And he's had a lot of success with the Rangers and Canucks, and, you know, also, of course, with the Manitoba Moose, you know, several years back. So Vigneault makes a lot of sense for me, but they're going to go with a coach that has that NHL experience. So I think Vigneault and Peters, for me, Drew, are probably at the top of the list.
If you're a Flames fan, and Bill Peters is at the head of the class for potential new head coaches, and you look at the job that he's done in Carolina for the last 3-4 years, where they haven't been a playoff team, he hasn't had any quality goaltending,
and he's calling out his goaltenders.
Flames have had goaltending troubles this, you know, for the last few years. Mike Smith was good up until he got injured this year. Is Bill Peters really the guy that gets you excited and the guy to whip into shape a potentially fractured dressing room from all things we hear?
Is Gerard Gallant's job available?
No, he's not available. He's in Vegas.
Yeah, I don't
think he's going anywhere.
I think the Alain Vigneault name really it strikes me as something I can relate to here, because just you talked about the experience, Ezzy, and a team that needs to improve. First of all, their special teams. Power play was 29th in the league, so they definitely need to shore that up with the amount of talent they have. And they lost 10 of their last 13 games with a bunch of injuries. So, you know, a lot of talk of the structure and whether that worked for the Flames. So they need a coach that can instill a structure that, A, the team can be confident that they'll not only win, but their offensive players can thrive. And I'm not sure, is Daryl Sutter the kind of guy that you allow young offensive players to thrive under?
No, he didn't do it in L.A. It was all about the system in L.A. and defense first. Now, that might not necessarily be such a bad thing in Calgary, but we saw, you know, what happened when you stifle creativity on your
Tortorella in Vancouver, right?
or this year Ken Hitchcock in Dallas. Mm-hmm. They went from being a terrible defensive team to being a better defensive team, but then the offense dried up as well. You're listening to TSN 1290. This is NHL This Week. We're talking about Glenn Gullitson being dismissed as head coach of the Calgary Flames and who a potential new head coach there in Calgary might be. Do they need to do things to the dressing room? Do they need to maybe ship out one of the key members of that team in Calgary? When you have such a disappointing year and you have such an epic collapse,
that the Flames had this season. We've talked about it throughout the last number of weeks. We've talked about it with George Johnson. We've talked about it with Kristen Anderson of the Calgary Herald.
Yep.
Do they need to maybe shake up the core a little bit? We've heard people like Elliot Friedman say that the core is potentially at risk there in Calgary. Is that something you can keep an eye on this offseason?
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, when you're talking about the core, we talked about Sean Monahan. We talked about Johnny Gaudreau. We talked about Matthew Tkachuk. Obviously, you know, the big horses on the back end, you're talking about Dougie Hamilton, Sean, Mark Giordano. They brought in Travis Hamonic last summer. You know, Sam Bennett is a young hockey player. You know, he, you know, hasn't been in the NHL for that long. You know, Michael Backlund actually had a really good year. I really like his game. He's been the second line center there for what it seems like, I don't know, the last 5 or 6 years. So
just signed a contract extension.
I don't know who you're moving out of that lineup right now, but I mean, this Flames team, I think, could have been much better this year. I really do. And I think if you had the right coach in there, I do think the Flames would be a playoff team. I mean, Mike Smith was brought in to shore up the goaltending. He did. Travis Hamonic was brought in, you know, to be a steady kind of second pair defenseman there. Mm-hmm. And he was good this year. And we talked about it. I mean, the big guns, you know, were really good. Michael Ferland was a guy who was on fire the first half of the season, and he kind of cooled off. It's really tough, Sean, to put your finger on, you know, what's really wrong with the Flames. I mentioned it earlier. I mean, for me, it's really not getting a lot of scoring from your third and fourth lines. And, you know, Mark Jankowski was brought in there, called up from the AHL, and, you know, he had varying degrees of success. I think you still have a lot to be excited about if you're a Calgary Flames fan. I mean, this isn't a team that's going to start rebuilding, but I do think that you have to maybe look at dealing from a position of strength to improve your roster. And, you know, Mike Smith, you know, is he your guy? I think they're going to stick with him. I don't know necessarily if bringing in another goaltender, you know, is going to necessarily make the team better. But for me, I think you maybe have to move a defenseman and bring in, you know, another forward. And, you know, I don't know if you want to move a Dougie Hamilton because you gave up all those picks to acquire him. What was that, 2 years back, 3 years back? So I think, you know, Brad Treliving has a lot of work ahead of him, not just a head coach, but I think he has to reshape that roster a little bit.
Quickly, the hit that Nikita Kucherov just laid on Sami Vatanen in the Devils Lightning game looked like it could have been blindside, looked like it could have been interference, looked like it could have been a hit to the head.
Also 4-0 Pittsburgh.
4-0 Pittsburgh now. Brian Elliott been pulled, Peter Mrazek in for the Penguins, but for the Flyers, but it doesn't make a difference. Based on what we've seen on the replays on the Kucherov hit on Vatanen, how similar was that to the hit that Drew Doughty got suspended one game for in that Golden Knights-Kings series? And do you think that Kucherov could potentially be in some trouble?
Yeah, I could see him getting a game for that, but it goes back to what we said earlier. I mean, shouldn't Marcus Foligno have been suspended one game for his hit on Jacob Trouba? I mean, that's pretty clearly a hit to the head if you ask me.
Sean?
I think we could see something out of this. Not only was just looking at some of the other hits in comparison, and the Vegas hit, the Drew Doughty hit, puck carrier is coming into the middle of the ice with the puck. Kucherov pretty much chases down, was it Vatanen?
Vatanen.
Blindsides him from almost, what is it, 7 o'clock?
Yeah, the angle, in, like 7 p.m. if you're looking at it as a clock.
So really, Vatanen has no means to protect himself, and he's lying on the ice holding his head, and there was definitely some collision with the jaw there, so I would not be surprised if we get if the player safety is back in the boardroom today for another look.
George Parros is a busy man these
certainly
playoffs.
A busy man. One quick last damning statistic when we talk about the Flames. Here's Brian Burke's last 9 years as an NHL team executive. 4 with Toronto, 5 years with Calgary. In those last 9 years, he has 2 playoff appearances, 1 playoff series victory, and 3 coaches fired.
Truculence.
Things might, if Burke is atop your hierarchy, things might not be going so well for your organization.
I wonder if they were like, hey, Brian, if you tie your tie up,
maybe the secret to success. Yeah. One team is through to the second round. That's the Vegas Golden Knights. When we come back, we're going to be joined by their play-by-play broadcaster, Dan Duva. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of hour number 2. Welcome back to the NHL This Week with a Legal Curve. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. You can follow us on Twitter at a Legal Curve, Facebook.com/a Legal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Legal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
There's one team that has advanced to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs. That is the Vegas Golden Knights. We're pleased to be joined by their play-by-play broadcaster, Dan Duva. Dan, good evening, and thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be with you. I'm still in disbelief, but to hear you say it must be true.
Yeah, you know what? You're not the only one who's in disbelief. A lot of hockey fans throughout the world are still in disbelief over what the Golden Knights have been doing all season long. You know, as we entered the playoffs, there were a lot of people who picked the Kings and thought that maybe the Golden Knights... Yeah, average end to the season, I think I can safe to describe it as, might end up being, you know, that Cinderella's had struck midnight and maybe the Golden Knights were going to be defeated by the veteran-laden LA Kings. Did prognosticators underestimate the Golden Knights entering this series?
Yeah, I think that they probably look at just the wins and losses and a trend or a plateau without truly examining what was going on. Reality is that the Knights had the largest division lead of any of the four divisions in the NHL, and several players were unavailable. And I don't just mean resting in the last couple of days of the season. I mean, William Carrier, fourth line left wing, only 3 points, right? But his impact is not measured in points or ice time. It's when he lands a check on Christian Follin to create the loose puck that leads to the only goal in game one for Shea Theodore. Now, he was out for 2 months. He comes back, and all of a sudden, what I have seen to be the best fourth line in hockey, Carrier, Nosek, and Belmar, but he comes back, I think it is a huge upgrade to not only the fourth line, but really how the Knights play overall. The success all season was the balance. The number of minutes for the fourth line compared to the top line was as close as any team in the league. And after game three, I couldn't believe I heard this from Gerard Gallant. He said, I felt bad that I didn't use the fourth line more. When was the last time you heard an NHL head coach say that? But that's what Turk said, because there were so many penalties, he didn't use the fourth line, in particular Carrier, during regulation. So the point is that for the folks who just see the wins not piling up as quickly, they failed to observe the absence of a role player like Carrier, and even Riley Smith, who was out for a month. And to me, Riley Smith was the glue for the top line. Marchessault was the leading scorer for much of the season. Carlson with the goals. But Riley Smith, so solid in just the trust in that line. So there are a lot of things to look at, and I think that the quote-unquote experts were probably not looking carefully enough as to why the Knights had been successful all year. Those guys are back in place. And, oh, by the way, the goalie is pretty good, too.
Dan, the Golden Knights are the first team to advance to the second round, but that also means they're going to have a lot of time off here. How does head coach Gerard Gallant make sure that the Golden Knights are focused on what's ahead and make sure that they don't spend too much time at Marquee Nightclub in Hakkasan?
Well, you know, George McPhee addressed the media earlier today and was asked that question. He said, in comparing this break to, say, Christmas break or the bye week or even the All-Star break, in those instances, the team is not on the ice. They really are away from the rink. And George said, we're not going to Mexico. So this team is off the ice today, off the ice tomorrow. But then they'll get to practice on Friday. And they'll practice Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Then they won't skate on Monday. And you don't know for sure when the second round will begin. And so they'll tweak the schedule perhaps middle of next week. And we'll see how it turns out. But they're still going to be on the ice. And I think that there is a less of a concern when you know that the group is going to be on the ice versus just having, you know, 3, 4, 5, or 7 days away from the game. That's not the case here. So I there really, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. It's happened in the NHL before. You'd much rather sweep a series and have time off than play 6 or 7 games and no time off. Any coach or GM would easily choose a sweep. And the way things are going in the Ducks-San Jose Sharks series, it looks like the Sharks are going to have some time off before the start of round two as well. But we'll be interested to see how the Ducks handle it facing elimination tonight.
Dan, the term, you know, unbelievable story is the understatement of the year when you describe this team and what they've been able to accomplish. But the unbelievable story has just continued to pile up as Braden McNabb scores the winner, the series-clinching goal against the team that let him go in the expansion draft to the Vegas. I mean, you can't write this stuff.
No, it's crazy. And sitting in the booth in Los Angeles last night, My engineer is a great, great man named Mike Noto. And I looked at him several times in the third period, and even when broadcast had ended. And I just kept looking at him, and I kept saying during the commercial breaks, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. And I don't use the word unbelievable very lightly. I've coached a lot of young broadcasters, and I often tell them, don't use the word unbelievable, because if you could believe it would have happened, then it's not unbelievable. To me, this is about as unbelievable a sports story as I've ever come across. And as you outlined, with Braden McNabb scoring the goal, he had only one other game-winning goal all season, and it was in Dallas back in December when the Knights were on the Father's Day, the Father's trip. All the dads came along to Dallas and to Nashville. It was one of the pivotal points of the season. So McNabb had a big game winner then, and he has this game winner in the series clinching game. He hadn't scored a playoff goal since 2011 in the WHL with the Kootenai Ice. So to do it against the Zone Club was really special. And just to underscore how unbelievable this is, not only do you have the participants and the numbers, and you've got Marc-Andre Fleury, who's won four games in a row for the first time since 2009. It's like if you've ever seen The Truman Show with Jim Carrey, like you're walking around, and you think, like, this can't be actually happening. But there's somebody's watching us, and this is all just some sort of orchestrated drama. So I suppose that someone's going to come tap on the window or pinch me or something, because I truly am having a hard time wrapping my mind around.
Dan Duva's our guest on NHL This Week. Dan is the play-by-play broadcaster for the Vegas Golden Knights. The Golden Knights obviously through to the second round after sweeping the Los Angeles Kings last night. Dan, it's a shame that the NHL won't start second-round series before the first round is completed in its entirety, because the Golden Knights might know their opponent as early as tonight if the Sharks take care of business out on home ice and finish the sweep of the Anaheim Ducks. How do the Golden Knights match up against the San Jose Sharks, presuming that the Ducks aren't going to stage an epic comeback, which it seems unlikely after they lost 8-1 in Game 3?
Yeah, it's interesting because the Ducks, a team that more resembles the Kings, whereas the Sharks more resemble the Knights, and that probably tells you something about the trend for postseason success in the National Hockey League.
Mm-hmm.
The Knights have done well against the Sharks in the regular season. You know, you look back to just the most recent games where the Knights had the Sharks and the Avalanche in consecutive games. That, to me, was one of the critical times of the year, because the Knights essentially knew they were making the playoffs, but they didn't tumble down the stretch. They did have those two really good showings against those clubs. So the speed game that has been the Knights' MO throughout the year, it's not just about speed on the rush and creating offense with terrific passing and out skating the defense. It's also speed in generating the forecheck. And I think that is an under-discussed aspect of the Knights game. And I think that there is a point where you can see how the Knights really wore down the Kings. And I wonder if, because that was such a strength in the first round, can the Knights do it again? Presuming that it is the Sharks in the second round, because they do have more mobility and more speed, especially on the back end. So that'll be an interesting matchup. You know, the Sharks, of course, have a good group of people who have been through the postseason before, and we have to keep reminding everybody that even though the Knights as a franchise are new, you've got a host of players with significant postseason experience. Look no further than James Neal and Marc-Andre Fleury, for example. But it's hard to say, you know, because what happens between now and the end of the Sharks-Ducks series. But we'll simply wrap it up by saying, as long as Melker Carlson and William Carlson are not on the ice at the same time, it makes the play-by-play guy's life a little bit easier.
You know, Dan, you just mentioned Marc-Andre Fleury, and he was obviously, you know, a star in this series. His numbers are pretty ludicrous, 0.65 goals against average, a 977 save percentage. But when you look at this Golden Knights team, I mean, you touched on it. You touched on the speed and the depth that they have. But is maybe the most underrated aspect of the Golden Knights their defense pairings led by Braden McNabb and Nate Schmidt?
No. You know, we had talked about this going into the playoffs, and I chatted with Braden, you know, before the first game of the Kings series. And at plus 26, was best among Golden Knights defensemen. And, you know, he's not the fastest guy or the flashiest guy. But coming into the year, he was not expected to be on the top pair. It was going to be Lucas Spezza and perhaps Nate Schmidt. And that's what it looked like for the first several weeks of the season. You know, there are several injuries that take place, and McNabb is reliable as anybody. He's got such a great stick, and he's as calm and cool as any defenseman I've come across. Reliable. That's why he got a contract extension this year. He solidified his role. And he jokes that, yeah, he's not a guy who's going to put up a lot of points. But in sensing how other teammates on defense have found success, the willingness to jump into the play, at least as a threat, wouldn't you know that that's how he scores the goal? It wasn't, you know, a set play in the offensive zone and a shot from the point. It was on the rush, and he had a beautiful finish. One of the better offensive plays I've ever seen from Braden McNabb in the NHL or even when I saw him in the American League. So when you have McNabb who contributes so much defensively, to see how he can be part of a very quick defensive core, and I include Derek Englund in that, believe it or not. And Derek Englund has found a way, despite being age 36, to really join the rush, and he's worked a lot in the offseason with the skating coach. He makes such great decisions on angles. That sort of stuff, you know, sometimes can go unnoticed. But I'm with you. When we talk about the players who've exceeded expectations with the Knights, yeah, you've got your William Karlsson with 43 goals. But for Braden McNabb, I can't recall thinking, wow, McNabb is going to be a top pair shutdown guy who is out there on every penalty kill, who's also going to be scoring playoff clinching goals. I did not think that. So I think that you're right. McNabb is someone who we don't talk about often enough as someone who's been a key contributor to this team.
Dan, going back to even before the series began, I was just doing a little bit of reading on just some of the festivities that were going to be going outside in Vegas and some of the things that the Knights were offering in their party areas. And I got to ask you, have you guys gotten a final count on the real tattoos distributed in the concourse? Because that was literally the craziest thing I've read in a very long time.
I have not heard a number. I don't know. I sat down next to Colin Miller in the Knights dressing room before game one of the series, and he looked at me and says, are they serious with this tattoo thing? And I had heard it mentioned, and I wasn't sure that it was actually happening. I said, Colin, are you going to go get one? And he's like, no, I'm going to just do the playoff beer. I said, okay, I'm going to stick with that too. So it's something that even the team, the players are aware of. But in terms of the numbers, I wish I could give you an answer on that. But I don't have an answer. But we did start to have a discussion of all the crazy places that someone might decide to put a Golden Knights tattoo.
Dan, as a follow-up question, is it true that Gary Lawless got a Golden Knights tattoo on his lower back?
Actually, the rumor is that he's going to put it right on top of his head.
Oh, that's too good.
Dan Duva is the Vegas Golden Knights broadcaster. Dan, congratulations on heading into round two.
Leave it on a high note, Drew.
Yeah, exactly. Leave it on a high note. Thanks, Dan.
Always a pleasure, guys. Thanks.
Take care. When we come back, we'll look at the Western Conference playoff series. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
San Jose Sharks with a most lopsided win here in Game 3, and now they need just one more W to move on.
That's an understatement.
Yeah, they made plays.
It was a lopsided victory. 8-1, the San Jose Sharks over the Anaheim Ducks in Game 3. Sharks can clinch that series tonight, Game 4 in the Shark Tank in San Jose. Anybody who predicted that both Pacific Division series would end in sweeps, raise your hand. Put your hand down, you dirty liar. The Anaheim Ducks performance is, I mean, it's got to be more than just concerning. To lose 8-1, I mean, it's hard to not use the Q word.
Ooh.
Of quit.
No, they didn't show up for Game 3.
Okay, so can you quit if you don't show up? Or maybe they, you know, do you have to show up to quit? I mean, whatever it is, to lose 8-1 after losing your first two games on home ice is just a damning testament to the Anaheim Ducks. And I don't know where they go from there for tonight's game four. I mean, if you have pride, maybe you lose game four, but if you have pride, you at least keep it as a close game. But if they roll over again, something's rotten in Southern California.
Yeah, there are going to be big changes coming up in Anaheim, unless they miraculously are able to come back in this series, Drew. I mean, we've seen teams come back down 3-0, but it just doesn't happen very often. And, you know, that game, I don't know if you guys caught that game, but, I mean, just absolutely embarrassing for the Ducks franchise. And it's really hard, guys, when you go down 2-0. And you know that it's already going to be a very long...
Especially when you lose those two games on home ice.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. And so, you know, Ryan Getzlaff has not been that great in this series. You know, he doesn't have a goal, even though he's known more for being a setup guy. But I just don't think that top line has been very good alongside, you know, Rickard Rakell and Corey Perry are on that top line. And, well, you know, we knew that they were going to miss Cam Fowler.
Yes.
But you can't blame everything on not having Cam Fowler. I mean, everyone knows that Cam Fowler is a terrific defenseman, maybe even a top 20 defenseman in the National Hockey League. But, I mean, you still have a good team there. And this is still a team that came very close if it wasn't for, you know, the absence of some defensemen. And we know that Getzlaff and Kessler were absent earlier in the season due to injuries. And I don't think Ryan Kessler's been very good in this series. Mm-hmm. He's been matched up against the top line of the San Jose Sharks. And, you know, the Pavelski line has outplayed the Ducks' top line. And the goaltending has been much better on the Sharks' side. I mean, John Gibson has not been good in this series.
No. The people in front of him haven't been good. He hasn't been good. I mean, you look at this Ducks team. I mean, Corey Perry's contract, well, that's an untradeable contract. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a shell of himself. Ryan Kessler's contract is an untradeable contract. So you wonder, you know, are the Ducks, I mean, they certainly were a playoff team this year. Second,
the rebuild might be coming. I mean,
well, are they the Chicago Blackhawks now with untradeable contracts after having success for so many years?
I think it's easier for this is just my personal opinion,
yeah.
Drew. I think it's going to be easier for the Blackhawks to turn it around and get back into the playoffs. But when you're talking about this Ducks team, I mean, let's be honest here. Again,
yes,
shout out to Cementhead, who loves it when I say, let's be honest.
Yeah, hopefully Cementhead's listening.
This Ducks team should be in this series right now. I don't care what anybody says. I mean, they could be in the series. They just haven't played really well.
They played fantastic hockey down the stretch.
Right, and when you think about the team, you know, that went to the conference finals last year,
mm-hmm.
The Ducks obviously lost to the Predators in the Western Conference final. I mean, the big boys are just not getting it done. We talked about it. I mean, Getzlaff, Perry, Rakell, Kessler. I mean, where's the offense?
It's not there. I mean, Getzlaff was an absolute beast in the playoffs last season. So far, he hasn't done anything.
Right,
I mean,
now, Hampus Lindholm is leading the Ducks in scoring, Drew, with 2 points.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's
three games, 2 points.
That's not a very good sign for the Anaheim Ducks. I just can't believe it's one thing to lose, and you know the Sharks are a pretty good hockey team, and I think it was a surprise to everybody that the Ducks caught them at the end to get home ice advantage in the first round in the Pacific Division. So it's one thing to lose. It's another thing to just be embarrassed like they were in Game 3. And that's where it's almost more problematic for the Ducks and for their post-mortem, which seems to be very shortly arriving, than anything else.
Yeah, Sean, and it's not just Getzlaff, Perry, and Rakell. I mean, Adam Henrique was terrific mm-hmm. for the Ducks after coming over from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't got it done here in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, some players that you expect to provide.
Jakob Silfverberg is invisible.
Yeah.
He's a guy that torched the Jets in their series
yeah.
many moons ago.
It's absolutely bizarre what's happening to the Anaheim Ducks. And the Sharks, as we said, can clinch it all later on tonight, a 9:30 puck drop for that game four. Another game four still to start tonight in about an hour's time. The Nashville Predators are in Colorado. The Avalanche won game three. Much like the Minnesota Wild did against the Jets, a solid Game 3 victory for the Colorado Avalanche. You know, the Avs have been more competitive in this series than I've expected. They opened the scoring in all three games.
Yep.
They've been demonstrating a pretty good amount of speed in those games. Sure, the Predators took the first two, but they're giving them more of a fight than I necessarily expected from the Avalanche. I think tonight's game four will be really interesting.
Yeah, well, and, you know, we talked about goaltending in the Duck-Shark series. John Gibson has not played very well. Pekka Rinne, who's, you know, the favorite to win the Vezina Trophy, whether you want to say it's, you know, Rinne, Vasilevsky, or Hellebuck, he's one of the finalists. He's allowed four goals in the last two games, and his numbers have not been good. Mm-hmm. He's had one good game out of the three games, so I expect a bounce-back game from Pekka Rinne, but you're absolutely right, Drew. I mean, not only did the Avalanche win Game 3, they've been competitive in this series here, and if you're the Predators, you don't want to go back to Nashville with the series tied 2-2. You want to make sure that you take care of business here in Game 4, and you know there is a chance that Cale Yarncroke plays tonight. He's missed the first three games of this series. He's been out of the lineup since he was injured in the game against the Jets, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, a guy like Cale Yarncroke, they've really missed him. I think the Predators have not played very well in front of Pekka Rinne, and, you know, the shutdown pair of Matthias Ekholm and PK Subban, they've struggled with that top line, and we talked about it. I mean, we said if, you know, the McKinnon, Rantanen, and Gabe Landeskog line could cause some problems for the Predators, you know, this series could be interesting. We'll see what happens here in Game 4. I think the Predators are still going to take this series, but you're absolutely right, Drew. They've made it, you know, a very competitive series.
And how about that play just quickly by Landeskog along the boards to get the puck to McKinnon for the breakaway? And just a quick note for tonight's Game 4, no Sam Girard for the Colorado Avalanche.
He missed Game 3 as well.
He missed Game 3 as well.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. A big thank you to all of our guests. We were joined by Dan Duva, Vegas Golden Knights broadcaster, Aaron Portsline of TheAthletic.com, and John Mattis of Post Media. In case you missed any of those interviews, in case you missed any of the show, it's available on our website, IllegalCurve.com. Also available for download wherever you get your podcasts. Get it sent to you automatically each and every week. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Great job behind the board, as always, for producer Rory. For Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Until Saturday morning at 9 a.m., we wish you good night and good luck, and thanks for listening to TSN Radio 1290.
As long as you stay together, the team will be all right.
This is NHL Midweek, the podcast on TSN 1290.ca.